The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles. Today on Veterans Chronicles, guest host Louis Sorley speaks with Shelby Westbrook, veteran of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen of the Second World War. Westbrook began his military career in March 1943 at Tuskegee Army Airfield after his graduation from high school. He then went to Italy to fly with the 99th Fighter Squadron of the 332nd Fighter Group. His missions brought him much success, earning him the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Air Medal with five clusters, and several other awards, eventually being promoted to First Lieutenant. His story begins reflecting on his early years prior to his service in the Army Air Corps.
I'd like to begin by asking you about your family origins and background. Where are you from?
I was born in a little town called Mark Tree, Arkansas. But my father and mother met in Clarksdale, Mississippi. In Mark Tree, my dad was a barber. And then after he, I guess, made a little money, he opened a restaurant cafe business in Mark Tree. And then he bought a little farmland. And in the course during the 20s, he decided to really become an American. He started selling bootleg whiskey. So there were eight of us in the family.
What number were you out of the eight?
I was number seven.
Oh, boy. Almost the baby.
Right. I was born January 1922.
And did you go through school there in Mark Tree?
I went from the first up through the ninth grade in Mark Tree.
And were there any military people in your family before you?
My mother had one brother. His name was William Foster. And he was in World War I.
Did he talk to you about his experiences?
No, but there was a book that was published in the 20s, The Negro in the Great War, by an author called Emmett J. Scott. And Mr. Scott was the former secretary of Booker T. Washington. And then in World War I, Mr. Scott was appointed a special assistant in the War Department for Negro Affairs.
Uh-huh.
And his book of 1922 was more or less a publication of military history and documents.
Yes.
And because my uncle had been a soldier in the war, my mother and grandmother had a copy of that book. So my brother and I, we didn't read the book. We looked at the pictures. The book was loaded with photographs.
Yes.
And at that age, you weren't reading too much, but you did enjoy looking at the pictures, and those have always stayed with me.
Yes.
I still have a copy of that book.
Yeah, what a treasure. And so that may have had something to do with your desire to enter military service yourself, do you think?
Because that book showed that there was a sense of responsibility and patriotism. And then I became a student of black history, and I got to the point where I could not separate black history from American history.
You said you went through, I believe you said, the ninth grade there. What happened after that?
Well, I lost my mother when I was in the seventh grade. Yeah, the ninth grade, I lost my father, so I went to Toledo, Ohio, to live with one of my brothers. And I finished high school in Toledo. I got out of high school, and I got a job working at an Army Ordnance Depot 30 miles east of Toledo, but it was an artillery depot for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in special artillery pieces. They test-fired them. They modified them. And they had a group of old World War I French 155 howitzers.
Really?
And one of the jobs I had as a welder there was welding brackets on that Hauser base so they could put pneumatic tires on there and tow them behind the modern trucks.
Uh-huh.
And the tanks, the brackets held air tanks for the air brakes. So I was there for 3 years.
Yes. Now, what years are we talking about?
We're talking about 39 to 43.
Okay. So now we're up to the point then of where you're going to enter military service. Is that right?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, while I was still at the Ordnance Depot, the draft board was getting real close. So I decided that I would rather try the Air Force than the infantry. So I volunteered. Well, I took the exam for Air Cadet.
Yes.
I came from Toledo to Chicago, and there were probably a couple of hundred guys there. There was only about five or six of them, black guys, and began that the Air Force for flight training only wanted college graduates. Then they ran out of college graduates.
Yes.
And they said, well, 2 years college. And they ran out of two-year college. So then they came up with this exam.
Okay.
You can take it and pass it, and you can qualify. So that's how I got in the Army Air Forces. They had just changed it from the Air Corps to the Air Forces.
Now, I have already said that you're a member of the famous Tuskegee Airmen.
Yes, sir.
Did you go to that outfit right away, or how does it work once you got accepted in the program?
Once I got accepted in the program, they put you on a waiting list. You get sworn into the service, but you had to wait for the class position to open at Tuskegee before you were called to active duty.
Okay.
So I was sworn into the service in October of 42, and I was called to active duty in March of 43 at Tuskegee.
What happens when you get there?
It was run almost like a college program or like the academies, you know. If you were the incoming class, then you had pre-flight, primary, basic, and advanced. So when you got there, you were in pre-flight. The guys in primary just started flying, but they would haze you and put you through the ringer.
Now, how many entered with you?
My group was the first group of black guys in what was known as college training detachment.
Okay.
Those college training units had already been in use around the United States in white colleges.
Yes.
But there were flight training at Tuskegee prior to my group getting there. There were about 300 of us. We went through Keesler Field for basic training, and then they shipped us to Tuskegee, the campus, for part of the college training program, where they gave you geography, math, and whatnot. And then from there, they moved us in groups of 50 to the primary base training for cadets.
Now, when you started flying, what kind of aircraft were they training you in?
We were trained in the old Stearman, PT-19, I think it's called.
And did you know then what kind of combat airman you were going to become?
Yes, because the only plane that the black guys were flying were P-40s.
Right.
But halfway through my cadet training, they brought in twin engine training then also. So you had a choice. You could either be single engine or twin engine. I stayed with the single engine.
When do you become, let's call it, an operational airman instead of a student pilot?
Well, the training period actually is only about 8 months.
Okay.
You have a month in lower primary, a month in upper primary, a month in lower basic, upper basic, lower advanced, upper advanced.
March on through.
You got out of upper advanced, you went to the P-40s.
What was the attrition rate?
I'd say the attrition rate was probably 30%.
Yeah. Did you find this difficult?
Well, in a way we did, because once you develop friendships like that, and you're rating yourself along with your friends and buddies, because every day you took lessons, you took your flight training, and you discussed it, you know, during the evenings and that. And then when somebody would get washed out, you know, you couldn't understand it.
Like a death in the family.
Right. Because they were flying the same things you were, and, hey, they weren't killing themselves.
Right. Yeah. Who were the instructors, basically? Were they civilians or military or who?
Well, for our primary training, which was the PT-19, the steerman, mm-hmm. all of our instructors were black aviators, mm-hmm. civilian aviators. And then when we got to basic, then all of our instructors were white army, right? So our instructors in basic and advanced were then all white. But our primary instructors were all black.
At what point in the training did you receive a commission?
When you finished upper advanced, then you got your commission, and then that's when you checked out in the P-40s, the regular fighter aircraft.
And were you assigned to an operational unit then or later?
You were assigned to a fighter training unit, and then the instructors in the fighter training unit, when I got there, were all Tuskegee Airmen who had put in a tour of duty in Africa and Italy, and now they were back, and they became our instructors. Prior to that, all of the instructors were white.
Yes.
But then once the first group of black pilots had put in their tour of duty, returned to the States, then they became our fighter instructors.
After the break, Westbrook continues his story as he discusses his deployment overseas following the intensive training he received at the airfield.
The stories of America's fighting soldiers, sailors, and aviators, unfiltered. Join Gene Pill as an honored roster of guests tell their stories from the front lines of war. Listen to what happened during our nation's times of war from the people who experienced it. Hear it each week on Veterans Chronicles.
Listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Tuskegee Airman Shelby Westbrook flew 60 missions over 12 countries in the European theater of World War II. His conversation with Dr. Lewis Sorley continues as he shares his experiences as a combat pilot in the Second World War.
That must have been very gratifying.
It was.
Yeah. And I imagine you made some friends for life there. Now, when did you get deployed, or how did you get overseas?
I got my commission in February of 44. I had maybe 6 months of fighter training in both the P-40, P-39, and an introductory flight in the P-47. And in July of 44, we shipped out for Italy. So I joined the 332nd Fighter Group in July of 44.
Did that unit operate from the same base throughout, or did you move from base to base as the war progressed?
In Italy, we stayed at the one base. It was called Ramatelli. It was about 40 miles a little northeast of Foggia. And most of the 15th Air Force bomber groups were from Foggia south to Bari, near the toe of the boot.
Tell us if there was such a thing as a typical mission. Tell us what that would be like, you know, the number of aircraft involved, the length of the flights and all that.
Well, a typical mission, you had possibly 600 to 800 bombers in a year.
How many escort aircraft might there be?
Our group on an escort mission, we had 72 airplanes in a year. So you had 5 escort units. There were 4 P-51 and 1 P-38 unit doing escort duty for the 15th Air Force. And if you look up, you could see airplanes going in both directions.
Yeah.
Like little birds or
geese
in the air. There were so many of them.
Yeah. And would these take place around the clock or?
No, just during the course of the day. The average mission for us could be between 5 to 6.5 hours.
And how much?
For the bombers, it was like 6 to 8 hours.
They came from farther away?
Yes.
You picked them up en route?
They were slower than we were, so it took them that much longer to go to the target and back.
Yeah.
See, in order to fight aircraft at a higher speed than the bombers.
Sure.
Or you escort it. What you do, you would more or less do back and forth to maintain position.
Yeah. So you could keep your speed up.
Then. Right. So we could keep up with them.
Right. Right. And where were most of the bombing runs headed for? Where were the target areas?
Well, primarily, the target area was northeastern Germany around Poland and southeast over to Ploiești, Romania.
Oh, yes, a famous place.
Right.
Yes.
We had a few missions to Athens, Greece, which is farther south, but primarily the major targets for the 15th Air Force was the German refineries for making oil.
Yes.
See, Europe only has one area of oil wells, and that was the Ploiești fields in Romania.
Yes.
So they supplied, I later understood, 40% of the fuel that the German military used. Their other 60% came from synthetics.
Mm-hmm.
They had refineries scattered all over the area where they had coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they created their oil.
Now, for you personally, what was the war like? Would you fly most days, or how did it go?
If the weather was good, you flew.
Did you fly the same airplane all the time?
I did, yes. We flew. We were assigned the P-51 Mustangs, so that's all of my missions were in the Mustang. Some of the early guys, they started out, they flew P-40s over Anzio.
Did you name your aircraft?
Yes.
What was it called?
Well, my dad's nickname was Lil, L-I-L, so I called mine Little Lil.
Okay. And how many missions did you fly?
I put in 60 missions total.
Wow.
But I went down in enemy territory, they called it, on my 31st mission.
How did that happen?
Well, I got flak damage over around the Regensburg area of Germany.
From flak?
Yes.
Yes.
On an escort mission. And the weather was bad, so I was told by the flight commander to try and get back to the base. So he put the wingman with me, and we started back trying to get back to our base in Italy. And there was a radio frequency that you could supposedly call and get a bearing as to direction to take.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that the Germans also mounted the same.
Oh, damn.
From where I was probably out of the range of the American radio system. And this German guy gave me a bearing that directed me straight to the mountains in Yugoslavia.
Oh, dear.
When we return, Shelby Westbrook recounts his travels throughout the European theater of the war, navigating through unfamiliar terrain after being hit by enemy fire on his 31st mission.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network. From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles.
World War II combat pilot Shelby Westbrook encountered difficulty on his 31st mission after being hit while returning to his base in Italy. His story progresses as he shares his encounters with British intelligence officers Randolph Churchill and Evelyn Waugh after belly landing his aircraft in a Croatian field.
And did you have to put the aircraft down there?
Yes, I put it down because I came out of the weather there and all I saw was mountains.
Yeah.
And I had an airplane that wasn't functioning right. So I circled and found an open area, set it down with wheels up, and it was just a big sled.
And you got through that without being injured?
Yes.
And then what?
So did my wingman. We both sat down.
Yeah. And then what?
And then we started trying to figure out where we were. And we hit a little country trail, like, and we started walking that. And all of a sudden, we turned a bend, and there were a group of guys in German uniforms with rifles at the ready. So he and I, all we had was 45s. And so, hey, nothing to do, but we just stopped. And then all of a sudden, they all put their rifles on their shoulder.
Yes.
And we noticed that they had the little red star on their cap. That was Tito's partisans.
Really?
Yes. And they knew there were no black Germans. So we had no problem.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
So did you make your way back then from there?
They took us to what was known as a building where there was a group of British officers.
Huh.
That was the connection between Tito and the American and British command in Italy. And they had made an agreement with the partisans that if they rescued downed airmen and got them back to Italy safely, then the British and Americans would furnish them with weapons, food,
yeah,
whatever.
Quid pro quo.
Right. And it turned out that this particular liaison group was the British author, Evelyn Waugh, and Randolph Churchill.
Wow. That's some pretty high-powered company.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
So they took us in. They gave us a little lunch and that and explained things to us.
Yes.
And then they contacted one of the Tito partisans, and they took us to a little village called Glenna, which was a safe area where they would group down airmen and wait for a time to work them out and back to safety.
And how did you travel back?
Well, you did a lot of walking at night.
You traveled by Shank's Mare, huh?
Yes.
Did you walk all the way back?
Pretty much.
My, how long did that take?
Well, we were there for a little over a month.
Yes.
And our last, say, 10 miles was by a truck. And it had to go over a mountain highway that had been, in sections, had been blown out by the German demolition folks.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks had repaired those roadways with bushes and limbs.
Whatever they could get.
Yeah, make like a basket and fill it with rocks.
Yeah.
And that truck, whenever it hit one of those things, you could look over the side, and it was a sheer drop. And you'd hear the rocks and stuff falling out. That was the most hazardous part of the truck.
Oh, that was scarier than flying, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. But it turned out there's a little seaport. It's a deep water port off the coast of Yugoslavia. In our day, it was called Zara, Z-A-R-A. On the map today, it's Zada, Z-A-D-A.
Mm-hmm.
But the British had brought in there a cruiser with commandos and taken control of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were using to bring in supplies. And the partisans took us, turned us over to the British Navy. We spent the night on a cruiser, and then the next day there was a destroyer there. They put us, there was about 15 or 20 guys. They put us on a destroyer, and they brought us over to Ancona, Italy. And we were flown from Ancona down to 15th Air Force headquarters at Barrie. And first thing they did, they sent us through the delousing system. The Evidently, folks then didn't know that DDT could kill you.
Yeah.
If they sprayed you with DDT, run you through
big
the
Big time, yes.
You come out, you got sprayed a second time. And then they fed us, and we went through interrogation. And that was Thanksgiving of 1944.
Yes.
That's the day we got back.
Now, when you're making your way back in this way you've just described, did your outfit know that you were safe?
Yes.
Yeah, they had gotten word of that.
They had, yes.
Yeah.
Because usually if the guy, if you lose a pilot, they take up your personal belongings, and then they ship them back to the States.
Yeah.
So they didn't ship our stuff. They kept it there.
Yes. Now, that's a great story. You said that was your 31st mission, so yeah. You flew almost as many missions after that.
I flew another 29 after that.
Yes. So when you'd done your 60 missions, where were we in the war by that time?
We were pretty much near the end of the war by then.
Yes.
See, there's one story that is seldom mentioned. In fact, I have never heard anybody mention it except myself recently.
Mm-hmm.
There was a book published called Ploesti. It was by Random House, I think, in 62.
Mm-hmm.
31st of August in 1944. The government of Romania made a deal with the American Air Force. They had over 2,000 downed airmen as PWs.
Hmm.
And they said that since the Russians were slowly moving toward Romania, they informed the Air Force, 15th, that if you come and pick these guys up, they will have them ready for you.
You can have them.
Right.
Yeah.
So the 15th Air Force, I thought it was 50 B-17s, but the book, after I read it, said there was like 38. And each B-17 was supposed to pick up 20 men. So these 38 or 50, whatever they were, we escorted the lead group of B-17s into the airport at Bucharest, Romania.
Yeah.
And the book, the story is describing one of the PWs who was there, and he said that this buzz job of P-51s came across the field. So that buzz job was four P-51s. It was, the leader was Major Campbell, our squadron leader. I was number four in that flight.
Ha.
And the buzz was supposed to for him to get a signal from the ground, from the area, as to whether the mission would still go.
Okay.
So he buzzed the group, and then B-17s came in, and we flew a cover where they were loading, and then other fighter groups came in and picked them up and escorted them back to Italy. That was a two-day mission, the 31st of August and the 1st of September.
Yeah.
And they recovered over 2,000 PWs.
Were they all Americans? Or
yes. Most of them were Americans.
Uh-huh. That's a great story. You orbited while they were being loaded.
Yes.
And then did you have to go back because of fuel, and that's not why the other outfit came in?
Right, because that was close to a 1,200-mile round trip.
Yes.
And so you had to figure out the time for travel, for the loading process,
yes,
and all of that.
See, yeah.
For the length of the mission.
Great story. When you finished your 60 missions and the war was nearly over, did you redeploy then or come back home?
No, I came back home.
Yeah.
And then I went for reassignment to Atlantic City. And I went through what I thought was some options of what I might want it to do, being reassigned.
Yes.
And there was an engineering school run by North American Aviation, aircraft engineering.
Uh-huh.
It was a government-sponsored program, but it was under the control of North American Aviation. And I put in an application because I did have some engineering education and experience.
Uh-huh.
And they turned me down. But there were several other guys who were there that got accepted. And their experience didn't compare to mine. So then I figured, well, if I'm going to go to engineering, I'll have to do it on my own.
Yeah. So, was that a case of racial prejudice, do
yes.
you think?
Because later on, the CEO of North American said that he would have no black guys yeah. working for his company.
How disappointing after you'd come home after such a great service in the war. What did you do instead?
Well, I went back to my old job temporarily to just get myself oriented. And then I came to Chicago and enrolled in Technical College for Electronic Engineering.
And what did you do after you'd gotten that education? What field were you in?
I was in television and industrial electronics.
Were you?
Yes. I started doing some contract work around the city in industrial electronics because then television was just in its infancy.
Right.
So it became a field.
Yes.
And then one Sunday I was looking through the ad section of the Chicago Tribune, and I saw an ad for electronic engineer. And the thing that puzzled me was the address. Chicago, the financial center of the city, is on Jackson Boulevard and LaSalle Street. And that's where this address was.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to try it out.
Check it out.
So I went to the address, and I had to go to maybe the 12th, 14th floor. And it was the corporate office of the John Morrell Meat Company. At that time, they were the fourth largest meat company in the United States. And the receptionist told me to sit down. Someone would be with me. And then an elderly white guy came out in shirt sleeve and suspenders, white hair, and took me into this room with the little application booklet. It was the boardroom of John Morrell.
Yeah.
The guy was the CEO.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. His name was W.W. McCallum.
Yeah.
He had decided to start building vacuum packaging machines for the Morrell plants.
Okay.
And this was sort of like his little personal entity.
Yes.
And he was hiring the folks to do it.
Yes.
So I got hired by the CEO of the John Morrell Company.
Things are looking up.
Right. So I got turned down by one CEO and got hired by another one.
That's great. And so then that was your main career then.
Yes.
After that. Now, these days, of course, everyone knows about the Tuskegee Airmen.
Right.
A very famous outfit.
But everybody doesn't know about our size. The movie with Lawrence Fishburne was a totally good story.
Yes.
But it does not depict our size. On the average escort mission, we would have 72 airplanes in the air each mission.
Yeah.
That's not a token force.
No, it isn't. No, no, no. That's a major force. But it seems to me that an important part of your life after your military service might be maintaining ties with those people with whom you served.
Yes,
is that true?
It sure is.
Reunions?
Because, see, altogether, there were more than 15,000 Tuskegee Airmen.
Wow.
We had five airfields here in the United States, primarily all black. We had a base with four groups of twin-engine bombers. We had training for fighters out of Selfridge Field, Michigan, Walterboro, South Carolina. We had a group that was over in Europe. So after the war, we organized the Tuskegee Airmen as a vet group.
Yes.
And we had up to, I think, about 34 or 35 chapters here in the United States.
Including all those people you just described.
Yes.
Yes.
And then once a year, we would pick some major city and have a convention together.
Yes. And large numbers would show?
Yes.
So that camaraderie has extended for a lot of years since you...
Our first convention was in 1972 in Detroit, and it's still in effect.
Yes. It's been wonderful talking to you. Your service is marvelous. Thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you for having me.
Westbrook spent 4 years active in the Army Air Corps and 6 years on reserve. After his service, he attended college in Chicago to obtain a Bachelor of Science in Electronics and later worked as an electrical engineer at W.R. Grace & Company. He continues to speak at corporate events and colleges, sharing his story as a pilot with the famed Tuskegee Airmen. Coming up next, this week's Profiles in Valor.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.